This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back to Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5, and time for a checkup. Hey, good to get this man back in the studio, Dr. Angerizer with AltaPoint. Thanks for being in.
Oh, thanks, Sean. Good to be here.
You know, we have these conversations every month or two, and last time we were talking, and we kind of got into this a little bit, but we set a time for you to come back and talk about this because it was psychedelics and treatment for addiction. Mm-hmm. And this has been, gosh, you can't go in the podcast world without hearing all kind of descriptions of how this has been helping so many people. And then you hear, you know, the federal government moves slowly on this. So first of all, from a, you know, physician perspective, where are we on this? What are y'all seeing at AltaPoint for use in psychedelics?
Yeah, it's a really exciting area in psychiatry. So there, we've had a lot of research the last 10 years on using psychedelics, primarily in treatment-resistant depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, but also a lot of really exciting treatment that are research that's going on for substance use disorders.
Okay, right now. Can you put layman's hat on for me for a second? Is there any way to explain somebody like me how that works? I mean, I hear all this stuff, but what does it do?
Yeah, so the term psychedelic, I don't love that term. Okay. But when we say psychedelic, we're usually meaning what we call classic psychedelics. So those are substances like LSD, mescaline, DMT, peyote, ayahuasca. So these substances create really powerful experiences in people. So when they take a LSD or psilocybin, they'll have sensory experiences that are very unusual, like hallucinations or what we call synesthesia, like smelling colors. They can have very powerful emotional experiences, often very euphoric and positive, but can also be really negative and terrifying, you know, what people might call a bad trip. And then maybe most powerfully, people can have, for lack of a better term, spiritual experiences. So they can experience their own sense of their ego self kind of dissolving. And again, that can be very terrifying in some experiences, but can also be very euphoric. Somebody may have an experience of being one with the universe. So again, people have used these substances for millennia to have these important transpersonal experiences. The real interest with using these medications clinically started back in the 1960s with LSD, and there was a lot of early research on using LSD specifically for heroin and alcohol addiction. But when we made these substances Schedule One, made them illegal, all of that research stopped recently.
It went from, like you said, I read some of the stuff early in the research, and then it was like verboten. It wasn't even, nobody was even really studying it that much because it was a Schedule One, right?
Yeah, you couldn't. It was illegal. And as we have begun to study these things again in the past 10 years, there are so many federal regulations that make it difficult. It's very, very expensive to do this research. But again, there's been so much interest and so much early indication of how powerful they are that it's really driven a lot of research.
Yeah, that's what I wondered, like the people that maybe went out on their own to do this. And I think about, you know, something that's obviously very important to you and me, and that's the veterans community.
Right.
And dealing with PTSD. Mm-hmm. And they on their own, really not with a prescription, had gone out, and you started hearing these stories. And these were solid warfighter, you know, and people that said, I was dealing with all this, and then I did this, and it seems to change some 180 in some cases, not just a lot of people, 90 degree, but 180, I mean, with this PTSD, with what they're suffering.
Yeah, and what's really different about these types of medications is that, you know, with a traditional antidepressant, it may take weeks for that to work, and then you may have to continue that indefinitely, maybe even for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. The thing that's different with these psychedelic medications is that one experience or two experiences may change that person forever, ultimately. And that's what we're seeing with things like PTSD and substance use disorders. It's just a one-time experience fundamentally changes that person's brain.
Okay. Because that's what I got to ask. Because I'm sitting here wondering, all right, so the person who's dealing with like a depression, right? We have these chemical things going on inside people's brains. You have medicine that is treated that it blocks things or does things. But this is not a regimen. It's not like they're getting up every morning and taking their mescaline or anything. Like you said, one or two times. Can you go back and test, and does it actually change brain chemistry? You go before the brain chemistry is A, after it's B, or how does
that? Yeah, it does change, Sean. And what a better term, I don't like the term psychedelic. When people hear psychedelic, they think of a hippie with a tie-dye t-shirt and holding up a peace sign. The scientific term that I prefer is neuroplastogen. And two reasons why I prefer that. One, it kind of gets some of that stigma of psychedelic out of it. But the second is that we it's not just the classical psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin that do this. There's other medicines like Ibogaine, MDMA or ecstasy, ketamine even, that is legal currently. That does. So what I mean by neuroplastogen, I'll kind of walk you through a little bit of a thought experiment. So we have I don't know if you've ever seen a college campus where they have the big green quad and there's like sidewalks everywhere.
Sure.
And it's going every which direction.
Yeah.
So what happened is there was a big green space. There was a student started to take a shortcut between two of the buildings. They create a little dirt path. Once there's a dirt path, they keep walking down that.
Yeah.
And basically eventually the university gives up and they just build a sidewalk.
Yeah.
That's kind of an analogy for what happens to our own brains as we get older. As we mature, we have certain ways of responding behaviorally, certain ways of thinking about things, certain ways that we tend to respond emotionally. And as we mature, as we get into our 20s, those ways become pretty fixed. We have our personality. You know, I might be an angry person, a calm person. I might be real social. I might be more quiet. Those personality traits become pretty fixed as we become adults. And when we talk about the types of disorders that these substances seem to treat, like substance use disorders, depression, anxiety disorders, PTSD, that's even more rigid. So people have very inflexible ways of responding to the environment.
Okay.
Their personality traits, their emotional responses, their ways of thinking are very, very hardened. So what all of these medications do is they actually put the brain into a more flexible state. It's almost like returning the brain back to adolescence. So again, back to our college campus analogy, it's like taking a jackhammer to those sidewalks and allowing new paths to form. So
great analogy. This has helped me understand.
Yeah. So if we, why is this so powerful? So somebody goes to Mexico and they use a medicine called Ibogaine because they have a really bad opioid addiction. That puts their brain into a more flexible state, where if they combine that with some really good psychotherapy recovery programs, they can have different paths. So they're not stuck in that same fixed way of behaving.
I mean, it's hearing you talk a little bit of a reset, right? You have these fixed habits, and that person who's addicted to opioids, to get to this feeling, they have to take this thing to get there. But now we go back to maybe a mind before that trail became so hardened.
Yeah. I think back to when you were 16, you could kind of reinvent yourself.
Sure.
And you could say, hey, I've been kind of a jock. Hey, maybe I'm going to try to be a theater person now.
Right.
Or,
sure.
You know, I'm going to try to be more social. And you know, when you were younger, you can learn new languages so easily.
Well, that's right. When you were talking, I was thinking about that. You know, when you get your kids to speak another language, do it while they're learning English as well, because it's just as easy at that point. Try doing that, you know, in your 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty darn hard.
Yeah, and it's because our brain, part of that maturation process is that we do have pathways that get fixed in our brain, and that's supposed to happen. That's kind of the process of life learning.
Yeah, but if you got a bad path we're talking about here, then this gives you a chance to reset a new way. So that's how this works.
It is. And one of the really interesting questions right now is whether we have to have the experience to have this happen. And there's a number of drugs that some pharmaceutical companies are developing that create the same neuroplastic changes in the brain without that powerful hallucinogenic experience. And we don't know whether that's going to work or not.
Is it just the chemical functioning on the brain, or is it this, like you've talked about, people having epiphanies and seeing, you know, loss of ego and you know.
Yeah. And there's no doubt that those experiences are meaningful in themselves. So, you know, when people have done some of these clinical trials on psilocybin, they'll say that was one of the most meaningful experiences of my life. So that experience certainly can be very powerful, but it may not be necessary. And that's the really, really interesting question now.
And that would be important too. Is that people like something like that to me is frightening. Right? Is that the experience of, I mean, that would be frightening if somebody that might be a, that may keep people from, all the number of people from doing this that possibly could, if they say, hey, you'll have the same changes, but you're not going to have the, and I don't try not to get on the same, but a trip, you know, right, of right. some sort.
Yeah. And that bad experience, that bad trip could be psychologically very dangerous for some people too. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people that.
So possibly these drugs would come out and it would take, that part would not be there.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. And again, that's a big question mark, whether that's going to work or not. But we will see. There's a number of medications that are moving pretty advanced into trials to really see whether they're effective without that experience.
Well, I mean, they're moving quickly enough that, what, in a year or two, you're sitting here with me talking about these things being like something that, you know, people can get prescribed, or we think in 10 years?
It's, if you asked me 10 years ago, I would have said that they'd already be approved by the FDA, but that hasn't happened. Our kind of the biggest setback in this movement was MDMA went in front of the FDA a year and a half ago, and it actually got rejected by the FDA. So there was a lot of hope that was MDMA being studied specifically for post-traumatic stress disorder. So that was a big setback. There are a number of other agents that are moving forward, but whether the FDA will approve them or not is a question.
What did this really deep dive here? We'll wrap up in a second, but did the FDA say, okay, we're not approving this MDMA because ABC, if you go get us the answers on ABC or whatever and come back, can you get another bite at the apple, or are they just get out of here?
Yeah, I'll tell you the major problem is what the FDA wants to see with a new medication is what they call a blind placebo. So, you know, I'm testing a new antidepressant. Half the patients will get the antidepressant, half will get a placebo. Neither the person in the study or the investigators know which one they're getting. And then we see which group got improved more. Right. So that's really the class. Kind of double blind placebo study that we want.
Do you think somebody's going to run that test?
So what happened with MDMA is with these compounds have such powerful experiences that it's hard to have a placebo.
Okay, yeah, right? You give me a blood pressure pill. I don't know whether you gave me a placebo or the blood pressure pill if I don't have a cuff on it.
Exactly.
So somebody, that makes sense.
So after the study's run, they'll ask the subject and the investigator, do you think the person got the drug or do you think they got the placebo?
It's pretty obvious.
So with the MDMA trial, both groups correctly guessed, you know, with pretty high percentage which one they got.
How are they going to ever do that?
It's difficult. So they're designing. They have different ways of trying to deal with that. They might give a medication that creates a weird experience, but not the same, mm-hmm. to kind of confuse it a little bit. They're trying somewhere. They'll give maybe a low dose of psilocybin in the placebo group, but a higher dose in the treatment group. Okay. And a lot is kind of in the way you set it up with the FDA ahead of time. And if the group is honest about, hey, this is going to be a problem, but this is kind of our strategy for trying to gauge effectiveness anyway.
Well, there's so much to learn about it. Thank you for coming back and talking about this with us. And I hope we'll do this again.
Oh, I'd love to, Sean.
All right, Dr. Luke Angaraja with AltaPoint right here on the Midday Mobile.